With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, George Saunders on his first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, and then historian Catherine Hughes with Tales of the Flesh and the Age of Decorum in Victorians Undone. George Saunders is the author of 9 books, including 10th of December, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and won the inaugural Folio Prize and the Story Prize. He has received MacArthur and Guggenheim Fellowships and the Penn Malamud Prize for Excellence in the Short Story, and was recently elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. In 2013, he was named one of the world's 100 most influential people by Time magazine, and his debut novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, is what we're going to be talking about today. George, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much for having me. What a pleasure.
The novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, you're an acclaimed short story writer. This is a departure for you, both in the fact that it's a novel and it's also a historical novel. How would you describe Lincoln in the Bardo?
Well, I heard somebody say once a novel is a long work of prose that has something wrong with it. So I think it falls in that category. It's kind of a, well, I actually ended up writing a novel in the form of a bunch of monologues. There's, I think, 200, 300 monologues. And so some of the people who tell the story are ghosts, and some of them are actually, some of the accounts are taken directly out of historical books. So it was kind of an unusual form. But it just tells the story of a night in 1862 when Lincoln, who had been president for about a year, lost his son. His son died of typhoid. And the newspapers of the time reported that Lincoln had been so grief-stricken about this that he apparently had gone into the crypt where the boy's body was being held on several occasions, the account said. So I heard that story 20 years ago, and I was just kind of so intrigued by it and moved by it. And so I finally just took a shot at it. And it's basically just the story of that one night in the graveyard, and, you know, hilarity ensues.
Tell us about the concept of the Bardo, first of all. It's a Buddhist idea, and you practice Buddhism yourself.
Basically, the Bardo in the Tibetan tradition is, it just means transitional space. So we're in a Bardo right now, which is the Bardo that occurs between birth and death. And then there's another one, and when people use the word Bardo, they're usually referring to this one that starts at the moment of your death and kind of goes to whatever's next. So that would normally be to reincarnation in the Buddhist tradition. So I think originally I thought, oh, that'd be really cool to kind of have this whole story take place in an accurate representation of that realm as depicted in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And then that idea went by the wayside pretty quickly, just because I'm not a scholar of Buddhism. And also it seemed kind of a restrictive idea. If you're going to write a novel, you have to be, you know, allowed to play and make things up. So the Bardo that I talk about is it's kind of transactional. You know, in other words, it's not really purgatory or limbo, because the person who's in there can get out if only he sort of understands his situation. So a lot of the Bardo beings or ghosts are kind of individuals who in life, you know, didn't quite get what they wanted, or were a little disappointed or heartbroken. And so they just, you know, they die, and then for whatever reason, they kind of lock up, like somebody who's about to leave a hotel but can't get out of the lobby. And so this is kind of the world where the spirit of this young boy enters into this group of people.
And they're also very much in denial of the fact that they're dead.
Right. Some of them don't know. Some of them know a little bit, but kind of, you know, they don't want to admit it. I read a lot of ghost narratives, and one of the kind of funny and sad things that keeps coming up is that the first sort of the go-to for a lot of psychics or mediums is to ask a ghost what year it is, and the ghost will, of course, get it wrong. And then sometimes just by correcting the ghost, by showing it a newspaper headline, the ghost will kind of go, oh, and then and go on to the next thing. They were just sort of trapped there by, I guess really trapped there just by the incredible disbelief that one has when you pass over. You know, you're living, and suddenly something happens, and in an instant you're asked to kind of process the fact that this thing that is you is now invalid and done for. And I suppose anybody would, these ghosts balk a bit at that.
And this Bardo also, there are appearances by, well, I'll say angels and demons, but in both cases, they're not in a form that we would recognize them as such.
Right. They're kind of, I imagine those are just being sort of, kind of overflow energy. And part of the thing that I kept trying to pull myself to was the notion that whatever happens after death, we would be incapable of imagining it from this side of the abyss. So I kept, just for fun, I kept trying to shake it up a little bit and make sure that the reader wasn't on too solid a ground in this after death realm. So there were these female beings that show up, and to some people they present as angels, and to some people they present as people from their lives, and we're not really sure if what their intention is. It's kind of like they're almost like caretakers of this region, trying to keep the flow of souls going. But yeah, that was for me the fun thing, was to have a pretty good idea of what different cultures had said about afterlife, and then say, well, let's take a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and then just sort of allow the imaginative process to take over and make this truly strange, maybe even comic kind of afterlife.
Tell me something else about the real life Willie Lincoln, because he's not that familiar over here in the UK. So who was he?
Well, he was kind of the one of the quotes that I found said that he was the kind of child that we all imagine we'll have before we have children. So kind of a real sunny kid, very intelligent, happy, not perfect, kind of a little hellraiser. But they said that he was the kid who was most like Lincoln in terms of his quick intelligence and his very personable nature. He died at 11, but he'd written a poem that he published at 9 or 10, and just, kind of a bit of a golden boy, actually. And then Lincoln and his wife took the loss very, very hard, because he was the one that I think they had the highest hopes for. So just kind of, and then the other story was he became sick at the same time as his brother, Tad. They both had typhoid together, and the really heartrending thing, I think maybe one thing that made me want to write this book, was the Lincolns had been planning this big reception at the White House, and they'd been planning it for several weeks. The boys got sick, and so there's some question about whether they should go ahead and have the party or not, and the doctor advised that it would be okay. So they had the party, big blowout, music coming up the stairwell while the boys were observed with fevers, and then that was actually the night when Willie took a turn for the worse, and then it was sort of a straight line to his death a couple of weeks later. So I think the parents, and I think some of the press, felt that this was, kind of a mistake, that they had this party, and there was a lot of guilt and a lot of regret. So it was kind of the death of Willie and the timing, with respect to the war and with Lincoln's presence. He was a very, like so many things in Lincoln's life, it almost seemed scripted. It was so dramatic. So when I started researching, there were all these events around the death that just seemed very wonderful, and you could pretty much just put them in as they were and make it a more dramatic story.
And as you mentioned, it's towards the beginning of the Civil War, and as happens with, I guess, most wars, it's turning out to be longer and considerably more bloody than anybody had anticipated.
Yeah, there was some sense that it'd just be a quick, almost a symbolic showing of arms, and then the South would back down. And this is just about the moment when, thousands of people were starting to die a day, and in particularly messy ways that they hadn't anticipated. So it's starting to sink into the country, into Lincoln, that this was going to be a mess,
So do we think the death of his son had an effect on Lincoln's continued pursuance of the war?
Well, that was kind of the open question of the book, because historically we know that Willie died on such and such a date, and that this battle preceded it, and we know what Lincoln did after. But whether or not, to what extent it affected the actual historical person, I think I just don't know. I mean, I know he was always, one of the last things he said to his wife, I think the day of his assassination, was that, Willie's death had hit them so hard, and now they had to really try to move back together to, to love one another and to be attentive to one another, who were, so mutually wounded. But I think that was, in a way, that was the open question of the book, was we can look at the mileposts, but of course we can't really know the internal psychology. It seemed to me, though, as a father and a husband, and that, when your personal life intrudes in that way, you can't help but project outwards into the world. So there's a moment in the book where he's thinking about how incredibly unimaginable it is to lose this beloved little guy. And then he kind of flashes on the fact that this is happening all over the place, in a sense, because of him and his administration, that thousands of young men, not much older than Willie, are dying. So my takeaway from it, and again, I probably I mean, this the story I told was that actually it would have the effect of tenderizing you a little bit and maybe making you more, you know, kind of recalibrating your inner ear to sorrow in other people. And then, of course, the problem is, even with that re-tenderization, the question is, do you, in the name of tenderness, stop this war and save all these hundreds of thousands of soldiers' lives? Then in the process, you're sort of cementing slavery, which, if he had backed out of the war, would not only have, it would have continued, and it actually would have grown, probably into Texas and Mexico. So it was one of those, I guess, those situations that liberals like myself don't like to think about, which is that, you know, you can say I'm for peace and love, and the world says, okay, peace and love in this case means peace and love for one set of people and not another set of people. So you get to a very kind of crossroads moment, as Lincoln did, where it's not a question of whether they'll be suffering, but in what flavor and with what result. So he was in a real fix, you know.
I'm Natalie Haynes, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
You mentioned that the book is split between the narrative of characters that reside in the Bardo and real historical accounts, either histories or eyewitness statements of the time. I wanted to talk about the latter for a minute, and in terms of like researching that, where those things came from. And I love the way you often use them in sort of contradictory ways. So there's a bit at the beginning where there's various different accounts of whether there was a full moon or not, and later on nobody could decide what color Lincoln's eyes are. You know, somebody says they're blue gray, somebody says they're green, somebody says they're brown. Tell us something about just finding that stuff.
Well, I just you know, I'm sort of a hobbyist researcher. I didn't start out, I kind of just started writing the book and then started researching as I went. And it's, you know, one of the things you notice in these historical accounts is that although a fact is a fact recounted gets a little wobbly. I think when Lincoln was killed, there was just a rush of people memorializing him and writing things down about him. And so there's quite a bit of disagreement in the historical record. So then it was fun to kind of to put that in and also to mimic it in other ways. And to me, I wouldn't say it was intentional, but in the end, it seemed somehow to reinforce this idea of an unknowable afterlife. Because not only is the afterlife unknowable, but even life is kind of unknowable. You know, it looks very solid and fixed, but the minute you get a few miles away from an incident and a few days away, suddenly that solidity is not so sure. So, you know, I mean, it's funny, you know, when you get to this point where you're talking about a book a lot, I think there's the danger that you reduce it a bit by making it seem as if you had it all figured out from the outset. But with this one, it was kind of just, you know, I'd been putting it off for 20 years and I just wanted to try it. And then the real experience was kind of 4 years of play, you know, just goofing around and trying to find non-lame ways to do things and kind of trying to spin the historical novel on its side a little bit and do something different with it. So these these historical things were sort of it was a solution to kind of arrive at speed, you know, just to the old problem of how do I get these facts in here without being pedantic, really. So I don't know, you know, it was a pretty amazing artistic experience that it's almost impossible to talk about it, but it was kind of a big intuitive run at this material. And every day just going in and trying to see, is there any way I can approach this stuff that hasn't been done before and that also might sort of do more justice to the emotional power and of the story. So this factual stuff was kind of a way of, you know, in a story that had a lot of ghosts and a lot of supernatural, almost sci-fi elements, the titration in of the facts was kind of a way of almost patting the reader on the shoulder and saying, it's okay, this is all true, you know, or this is at least has a spine of truth.
I said there's a huge cast of characters in terms of the people that are stuck in the Bardo, but the book has really three main narrators: Hans Volman, Roger Bevins III, and the Reverend Everly Thomas. Just tell us something about these three, first of all.
Well, each of them are there, as all these ghosts are, because something didn't sit right with them at the time of the death. So Volman is a guy who was literally just, half a day away from consummating his marriage when he died. So he's got that kind of on the mind, as you would. Bevins was a suicide who was kind of at the last minute, filled with regret. He wished he hadn't done it, and it was too late to stop it. So he's sort of frozen in a state of kind of fresh awareness of how beautiful the world is, and he's trying desperately to get back to life. And the Reverend, he's a little bit different. I won't give it away, but he's the one character in the book who kind of has a better understanding of where they are and why they're there. So the three of them, in my imagination, had been kind of, you know, bombing around this afterlife for maybe 10 years or so together. Friends, but also, you know, one of the things about this world is the longer it's very hard to stay there. It takes a real effort of will to stay undead, basically. And the longer you stay, the more you're kind of degraded. There's less of the actual you remaining. You become sort of a bit of a character of yourself. You keep repeating the same stories over and over again, and so it's kind of a sad, kind of a downhill run once you get in that realm. So the three of them have just been kind of friends, but in some ways it's kind of a sad existence. You have to be quite selfish in this realm. It's a little bit like, you know, if you ever read about the old hobos in the 30s, you know, they travel together, but since you know, everybody in the group is hungry and desperate, there was a kind of a code of the road where, you know, it was a friendship, but not a particularly amicable friendship.
And these three, as I said, they're the main narrators of the novel. They'll often be describing what each other are doing, but also addressing us directly with their own thoughts. And there are lots of other characters, and sometimes those characters address us directly. Sometimes their story is narrated by one of the three narrators, or sometimes a different narrator. And I wondered if this is what you were referring to in terms of putting together all of the conflicting historical accounts, in that often these personal narratives come in like in a flood, and that is from all different directions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things I think pushes a writer in some direction over the course of his or her career is that you're trying to find a form that seems truthful to you. You know, sometimes you start on a story and there's something about it that feels that in the name of making a narrative, you're falsifying somehow. So for me, now this is just my thing, but when I try to do a sort of worldly third-person narrator, I really can't do it because I'm not that person. I'm kind of poorly educated and a little bit kind of a strange person, actually, you know. And so when I try to make a kind of Gatsby-esque narrator, it just feels false to me. Likewise, if I try to do, so far anyway, if I try to do a big Gogolian omniscient narrator, or let's say a big Tolstoyan omniscient narrator, I can't do it. I just don't feel like I have that kind of mastery of the world that would allow me any kind of authority. So what I find myself gravitating toward in the last few books is some way of modeling a kind of extreme subjectivity that says the world is basically made up of millions and millions of consciousnesses that are entirely subjective and mostly incorrect, as are we. You know, you go out and I'm sitting up here in the attic of Shakespeare and Company looking out on Paris, and I see all these people walking around. And you know that if you could enter the mind of each one of them, they're narrating the world from their, you know, particular limited point of view with themselves as the hero. And relative to, say, my point of view, they're probably wrong about a lot of things. Well, they're thinking in French, for example, or, you know, they have a different politics, or they have a completely, per me, skewed view of the world. Well, the most truthful view of the world, in my view, is exactly that times however many people there are in the world. So in this book, I think what I was trying to do in a sort of baby step way was to find a form that would let that viewpoint feel at home. So when you have a bunch of monologues, that's essentially what you're doing, is you're saying, I'm going to have a ghost tell me his story. I'm going to have another ghost tell me her story. There's no responsibility for those stories to link up or match up or even reinforce one another, and then so on and so forth, letting in historical accounts. I invented some historical accounts. And in the end, I think I was trying to go for cacophony, a kind of a beautiful cacophony or a polyphony of these different voices. And the truth is actually the sum total of all of those voices, I would say, or something like that, you know.
How do you, though, despite the fact that you just said that, you know, the truth is the sum total of all of those voices, all of those voices are distinct. Some of them might only have a couple of lines in the entire book. How do you make distinct characters when often they have such a fleeting appearance?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, I mean, this might be too technical an answer, but I had the idea sometimes that if you had, let's say you had 100 friends in your kitchen, and the job was to arrange them in the living room so that each of them was distinct from the other. And let's say, now we're going to go crazy, but let's say that they all looked exactly the same. There was 100 versions of the same friend. What you might do is you put one in there and arrange him into a posture. Then you put another one and arrange her into a different posture, and so on and so forth. And as you start adding people to the room, you know, you're constantly scanning the room to make sure that you don't duplicate the posture. So by the end, it's a little difficult, but you could theoretically get 100 people in the room who all have their hands and arms and legs and heads arranged in slightly different ways. Someone passing by that room very quickly might say, oh my God, there's 100 different people in there. So it was similar in this book. You start to write a character, and if he sounded too much like another character, well, that was no good. And you had to go back to the drawing board and make some changes in the way he spoke or the way he thought. So it was almost a matter of just, I mean, it sounds silly, but the way to make, you know, hundreds of characters is to not duplicate the same character twice. And what I found out was that the reading mind is so acute that you will, as you're reading, if I make a very slight difference between character A and character B, even on the level of typography, you know, or punctuation, you'll actually register that as a different person. And then the other thing that was helpful was just the idea that all these ghosts most, there's not a single happy one among them. So when you were saying, when you were looking for a character type, you would just say, well, what are all the different ways of being unhappy in the world? You know, what are the things that someone might regret enough to refuse to go on to heaven? So that's sort of an elaborate answer. The truth is it was by feeling. You know, every day I'd go in and just play around. And it's not that long of a book, so I kind of tend to read it from the beginning to wherever I was every day. So if I was duplicating a character, I would just become aware of it and fix it, basically.
Well, this is where I wanted to go next, because bearing that image in mind and also thinking back on what you said about, you know, having fun playing with the historical narrative over a number of years, I wanted to talk about how this actually ends up on the page. You know, the characters, do you write a character that has a substantial part in its entirety and then split it up, or does the thing come out as a sort of stream of consciousness almost?
It came in, it progressed kind of by the hour of 6 o'clock. So I would start, you know, just page one, page 50, page. So it proceeded very linearly in that way. It wasn't the case that I wrote them first and fractured them. But you kind of remember, you know, I wrote this guy back on page 20. If he's making a reappearance, you want to go back and read through that again, maybe even retype some of it just to get yourself into the zone, and then, you know, you return to page whatever it is. So it was much more a matter of trying to keep moving through the hours of that night, and then kind of in a certain way keeping an eye on where people were in the graveyard, and what kind of, and most especially what the even in short fiction, what's the purpose of this beat? You know, so we're here, Lincoln has just left the crypt. Okay, so then you have to kind of think, well, where is he going? Can I have him leave the graveyard? Should he stop somewhere? Meanwhile, what's happening here? So I guess I would kind of call it like a form of sequential housekeeping. You know, you're on page 40, and you don't want to go ahead to page 80. You want to stay in that zone, kind of refining the fictive reality so it seems real to you. And then the next beat was sort of up here, you know. So again, very much, for me, my whole approach is always kind of intuitive and also very iterative, like go back to the thing again and again and tighten it and loosen it and rewrite it and change it until everything that's behind me in the book feels to me as if it actually happened. And then I feel I can go ahead. It's very hard to describe, actually. I mean, it's sort of, you know, you sort of reduce it by describing it. But in doing it, it actually feels, not to make it too grand, but it feels a lot like sports. You know, and if you're playing sport, you're not really, you're there. You know, you're feeling it. You've had hours of many hundreds, thousands of hours of practice. And then in the moment of need, you do what you think is right. Now, maybe after, you know, in the same way that after a game, you know, someone can analyze what they did, but you always have that slight feeling that it's a bit false, you know, when someone says, how did you score that goal? And they say, well, I just, you know, and whatever they say is kind of bullshit because actually they just did it. You know, they responded in the moment.
We're pretty much out of time, but I just wanted to finish off asking you about the audiobook version of this book. It has the most incredible cast of anything ever, I think. How did it come about?
It really does, yeah. Well, I was reacting against the idea of reading the thing because I could not imagine a worse hell than to try to read, you know, 300 pages of 19th century dialect in the Chicago accent that I have. So I asked the producer if we could, you know, possibly bring on a few actors just to kind of, you know, maybe they could do some voices. And her name is Kelly Gilday, and she just somehow, I think she just felt a real professional challenge in front of her. So she went out and got Nick Offerman and David Sedaris to agree to do it. And then from there, we just started getting all these wonderful actors agreeing. But in the process, Kelly did a spreadsheet, and we needed, it turns out, 166 people to get it all done. And so she just went on the hunt, and she got all these great actors and Oscar winners. And then we still only had about 40 people. So then she went to the kind of audiobook A-list, all these people who are professional audiobook readers, and got a bunch of great people there. And we still needed about 60 or 70. And so then we got my mother and my father and my wife and my kids and people from Random House. And so in the end, we managed to cover every single monologue with a different speaker. So there's 166 people and nobody doubles the role or anything. So it's kind of a crazy experience.
And included yourself, we should add.
And I was fighting about that, but Kelly thought it would be good to have me be this guy, the Reverend, who's probably the closest thing to a narrator that's in the book. Yeah, it's a very different experience from reading the book, I think, but it's pretty unprecedented.
I've been talking to George Saunders. We've been talking about his debut novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, which is out now in the UK from Bloomsbury. George, thank you so much for telling me about it.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure. Thank you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Andy Miller, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Catherine Hughes is the author of award-winning biographies of Mrs. Beaton and George Eliot, both of which were filmed for the BBC. For the past 15 years, she has been a literary critic and a columnist for The Guardian. Educated at Oxford University and with a PhD in Victorian Studies, she is currently Professor of Life Writing at the University of East Anglia and Fellow of both the Royal Society of Literature and the Royal Historical Society. And Catherine's latest book is Victorians Undone, Tales of Flesh in the Age of Decorum. Catherine, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
So this book has a thesis, it has an idea. Tell us what the idea behind the book is.
Well, it really grew out of my dissatisfaction with writing biography about Victorians. And I've done that for the last 15, 20 years. And I've tried as hard as I can to get kind of close to the experience of famous people like George Eliot or Mrs. Beaton. But I still felt there was something missing. There was something, you know that sort of feeling you have when you wake up in the morning yourself and you think, have I got a tickle in my throat? Or is there something funny about my right foot? Or can I get away with not washing my hair today? All those little sort of physical kind of problems that we immediately register and stay with us throughout the day. Somehow those are never there in biographies. You know, the subjects of biographies are curiously disembodied. They have very clever thoughts. They travel around the world. They do all sorts of extraordinary things. They have great love affairs, great scandals, all kinds of sexual deviance. But somehow the body isn't there. And I just thought, I'm going to try and see if I can do something like that.
Is there a reason why the body has been left behind in biography? Because it wasn't always the case. And you talk about eminent Victorians, Lytton Strachey's book, which actually uses the body to mock its subjects. So I wonder if perhaps that's why people have subsequently been reluctant to talk about the body so much.
I think it's two things. First of all, I think you're absolutely right. It was that idea that actually if you touch upon the body, as Strachey did almost 100 years ago, it must be to mock. It must be to do a sort of, he's got a big nose, or, she's got funny feet. And there's a sort of, quite rightly, a kind of attack and a desire not to go down what I sort of call the carry-on kind of view of biography. You know, we're not there just to mock funny people in the olden days. So I think that's right. I think it's a sort of question of decorum and taste. I also think it's very simply the fact that these details are very, very hard to find. Now, when Strachey did it, as he himself would say, he made quite a lot of it up. So, for instance, famously, he said that Thomas Arnold, the headmaster from Tom Brown's school days, had legs that were too short for his body. And when somebody pointed out to him, I don't think that's true, there's no proof, is there? Strachey said, well, if they weren't, they should have been. Well, as a professional historian and biographer, I can't get away with that kind of sloppiness. I have to find real facts, and those facts are really, really hard to find. I mean, by and large, people write, of course, about when they're facing really, really serious illness. People will talk in their diaries and their letters. They'll write about the concerns and worries. But we tend not to write about, the fact that I think I've got an ingrowing toenail, or I think my right hand is a bit sort of feeling a bit funny. Do you think it means anything? Those precise details people don't write down.
And certainly, I mean, obviously, only generally for people at the upper end of the social spectrum, there would
start to be photographs and things as well. So there's those sort of records of what people actually physically look like.
True. From about sort of 1855, you're absolutely right, you get professional photography, and then later, you know, by the 1860s and 70s, sort of what we call high street photography. Mm. I mean, the problem with that, you probably know, is that in the early days of photography, one had to sit very, very still so as not to smudge the image. As a result, everybody looks very, very strange. I mean, nobody looks like themselves. Everybody's got this very, very kind of rigid posture, and their sort of faces are grimaced, and you don't get any sense of... I mean, you know, if you're waiting for a friend and they're walking down the street towards you, and you often know them not so much by their sort of features initially, but sort of by the way they walk, because actually just unconsciously you know the way they walk. Mm-hmm. You know something about the way their shoulders bob up and down, or the way that they sort of appear to kind of move from side to side. Well, those kind of details just don't come out in photography. And so I think it's... I mean, my worry always was, you know, that if George Eliot or Mrs. Beeson were to walk into this room now, I'm not sure I'd recognise them, even though I have spent years looking at images of them. I mean, it might be a giveaway, because obviously they'd be wearing Victorian clothes, but apart from that, I'm not sure I'd be confident enough to go up and go, you're George Eliot, aren't you? Because I'm not sure that I would recognise them.
You've given a few examples of people that are, you know, famous characters from history that we might not recognise. Charlotte Bronte, there's just been, just very recently, a fantastic BBC production about the Brontes, and they all had nice, genteel Yorkshire accents. Apparently this is not the case.
No, absolutely. I loved that television production by Sally Wainwright. Mm.
It was wonderful.
Wonderfully done. But we know from something that one of her schoolmates said, Mary, when Charlotte Bronte first goes to Roe Head, so that's the school after the sort of horrible school for vicars' daughters, the sort of genteel school, all the school friends, all sort of girls come out to meet her, and they notice that she has these very, very thick bottle specs, and that she has an Irish accent. Now, of course, that's because her father, Reverend Patrick Bronte, was from the northern part of Ireland. The family lived quite a sequestered life, and obviously they picked up that brogue. But you never get a sense of that, do you, in any kind of adaptation? As you say, they're all speaking a sort of slightly genteel sort of Harrogate Yorkshire.
And of course, we have this impression with Victorian times that attitudes to sex and the body obviously change over the period. Indeed, the book is subtitled Tales of Flesh in the Age of Decorum. But it wasn't like that shortly before. So Georgian times and the Regency times, which came just before, were much looser. And as you mentioned in the book, these were the same people. It's not like everybody left and a new cast of characters come in. The same people lived through all three periods. So... what changed?
You're absolutely right. I'm always kind of frustrated when I read history books and it talks about, quite reasonably, you know, as if the Georgians were these kind of loose, unbuttoned kind of, you know, people living for pleasure. And as you say, they suddenly sort of leave the stage and then their buttoned up sort of Victorian offspring come on. And of course, it's the same people. You know, we all of us now live for a long time. And so we all live through long periods of time. We are both, you know, 60s hippies and 80s career girls and, you know, 90s new world people, and so we go on. What changes, I think, is, I mean, I was particularly interested in this fact that from the end of the 18th century, people are pouring into the cities at an absolutely unprecedented rate. London, Bristol, Liverpool, Manchester, all these places are becoming these huge centres of population. And suddenly, people would have been very, very aware of other people's bodies in a way that just wasn't the case before. If you went to the theatre, if you went on a bus, if you simply walked down the street, if you went to a lodging house, you would suddenly find yourself absolutely kind of somebody's elbow in your face or your nose in their armpit, and not to be sort of too gross about it. Suddenly, there's a sense of other people's bodies, and that must have given you a kind of very, a much clearer sense of what the body was about.
The book is made up of, in the main, of five essays about different people, different parts of the body. And we'll look at some of those stories as we go through the interview. But to begin with, and to get us into the first one, Victoria herself, she has, as we would describe now, a body image problem, doesn't she?
Yes. I mean, I was very, very struck by reading the diaries from the early period, which are all available online. Anybody can look at them. Is that she is a young girl going through the sorts of things that young girls go through. So very anxious about putting on weight because she's only 5 foot. Really thrilled when she gets ill and it means that she loses weight. very, very worried about the fact that she's got rather a large bust, and actually the fashion is really for kind of quite, if you think about very early Victorian period, as it were, before Victorian England became Victorian, the fashion is quite different. It's much looser within the Georgian period, you know, a high bust giving way to kind of quite floaty kind of skirts. Victoria just doesn't look good in that look. It doesn't work if you have a well-developed bust, if you're not very tall. So she has all those kinds of anxieties. Also, she gets very depressed in the second year of her reign. This is before she's got married to Prince Albert, as well she might. The girl is in an appalling sort of situation. Being queen at the age of 19, not getting on with her mother. There's a war in Afghanistan. Europe is falling apart. I mean, these are extraordinary burdens for a young girl. But she does, I think, what any of us might do when we're under pressure. She starts drinking slightly too much at dinner. That, of course, makes her put on weight. And so everybody around her is sort of suggesting that she might like to kind of slow down a bit on the drink at supper. She starts gobbling her food. And some of the ladies-in-waiting kind of can't help noticing that, you know, when she pulls her lip back to eat, she's got these little rodent teeth, you know, so that actually the overall effect is of somebody literally kind of going at their dinner like nobody's business, and it's just not what you expect of a queen. Also, as she gets more depressed in that second year, she starts developing what we might call psychosomatic symptoms now. She gets a rash over her hands. She develops styes on her eyes. I mean, all these things will be terribly, terribly kind of familiar to anybody who's gone through a bit of a slump. But what's so interesting is to see that, as it were, embodied in this very ordinary little kind of dumpling of a girl who is supposed to embody sort of regalness and absolute beauty. And what do you do? I mean, it's a sort of body dysmorphia, and it must have been quite dreadful for her. She doesn't look like a queen. I mean, that's really the problem.
And one of the people that comes into that, her early court, is someone who very much is able to wear those thin dresses of the period. Lady Flora Hastings, tell us who she is.
Well, Lady Flora Hastings was a woman who Victoria couldn't stand. It's a sort of classic kind of situation of a sort of blended family. Victoria's father had died when she was a baby, so she didn't know him. And so she and her mother had been sort of constructing these, what we would call blended families now, with people coming in and out, father figures coming in, leaving and so forth. Lady Flora Hastings is imported into this household in Kensington Palace before Victoria's become queen to be her companion, to be her best friend. Well, I mean, no girl really wants their mother choosing their best friends, but in effect, that's what happens. So the Duchess of Kent, Victoria's mother, says that Lady Flora Hastings is going to be your new best friend. And naturally, Victoria is absolutely furious. Flora Hastings is almost 10 years older than Victoria. She is, in effect, the Duchess of Kent's eyes and ears. She is Victoria's mother's spy, as far as Victoria is concerned. And Victoria literally gives her the cold shoulder, will have nothing to do with her. I think Lady Flora probably had an unfortunate personality. I think she was a bit brusque. I think she probably was a bit nosy. But I think, you know, as far as Victoria was concerned, one of her greatest sin was that she was slim, rather attractive, and seemed to be very, very close to a man that Victoria couldn't bear, Sir John Conroy, who ran the household.
There's already rumours that Conroy and Flora are lovers, isn't there?
Well, there's been, I mean, this is where the story gets so crazy, which suggests this is a family that could have done with a bit of family therapy, because there are already rumours, before Flora even appears, that the Duchess of Kent, that's Victoria's mother, is a lover of Sir John Conroy. So Victoria has grown up with the idea that this man she can't bear is actually her mother's lover. Along comes Lady Flora, and Victoria, in her sort of slightly heightened, slightly, I have to say, sort of hysterical view of the world at this point, starts thinking that actually Flora and Sir John might be lovers as well. I mean, she's a highly sexual creature, Victoria. I think that is absolutely clear. And, you know, she's boy crazy at this point. I mean, no visiting prince is kind of slightly safe from her. And I think, you know, her imagination runs riot. So suddenly she's seeing kind of lovers everywhere.
I'm Emily Mayhew, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
And so let's talk about what happens with Flora then, because suddenly her appearance changes.
Well, that's right. What people often don't understand, and it never comes out in TV dramas around Victoria's court, is that ladies-in-waiting weren't there the whole time. They came into waiting for perhaps a period of 4 months, and then they would go away for the rest of the year back to their families, who were always, you know, great landed families, and then they'd come back to court. So in other words, there's a lot of come and go. What happens is that Lady Flora has been away from the court for a rather suspicious sort of 5 months. She comes back. Last time anybody saw her, she was looking slim and she's very svelte. She comes back at the beginning of 1839, and she seems to have put on weight. Specifically, she seems to have grown quite a large stomach. I mean, it would have been apparent because she was a slender woman. And it doesn't take the court very long, and it certainly doesn't take Victoria very long, to start suggesting that Lady Flora, who, of course, is unmarried, might be pregnant.
And this obviously would be a huge scandal if this was the case.
It wouldn't, it wouldn't. And this is the really interesting thing. Lord Melbourne, a man of the Regency, is completely relaxed about women getting pregnant. He thinks, yes, she probably is pregnant. Doesn't matter. I wish she'd just go quietly and deal with it, have the baby in the country and then come out. So in other words, it's both a scandal and not a scandal. But for Lady Flora, who comes from a very devout family background, it was the most appalling thing to be accused of. Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's something I found very odd about when I was researching the court, is that at one level there's a kind of worldly Georgian Regency quality to it. Everybody's at it. We all know this. And then you can have people like Lady Flora Hastings who are absolutely appalled to think that anybody would think that of them. I mean, it's absolutely appalling.
So these rumours go backwards and forwards, and then it basically becomes apparent that Flora is going to have to prove in some way that she is not pregnant. And this appalling examination takes place. Tell us about that.
Well, this is new. So, I mean, the story of Lady Flora Hastings has been known ever since ever. It's cut and pasted into biographies of Victoria, you know, all the time. Nothing new about that. What I was able to locate and discover was, first of all, letters that the Hastings family wrote as this was going on, and letters that Flora wrote about what was going on. And also, I came upon notes that the doctor who performed the examination wrote about how to go about examining a pregnant woman. Now, I don't have the case notes for Flora, but I do have a very full set of a description that Sir Charles Clark wrote about how to examine a pregnant woman, and not just to see whether the baby's okay, but also to see whether she's a virgin or not. And also what's come to light is a description written by Lady Flora's maid of what went on during a really horrible sort of 45 minute period when Lady Flora was examined by two doctors.
So this is, I mean, it's a catch-22 situation, because the doctors are going to prove that she's not pregnant, because she's not pregnant. But at the same time, the very act of examining her will ruin her reputation anyway.
Exactly. I mean, the reason why examinations were, especially for women, unmarried women, were so blushing and shameful was that it was the sort of thing that might happen to a prostitute, perhaps. You know, a suggestion that if she's harbouring some in the lock hospitals, which is where prostitutes were locked up, if they were suffering from a sexually transmitted disease, they were locked up, examined, treated before they were let back out. So to examine a single woman like in that way, and you know, we're talking about what we call an internal examination now, was deeply, deeply shaming, and in a very sort of strange way, turns her into the loose woman that she was accused of being. I mean, at the most kind of physical level, obviously, the act of the examination would have penetrated her hymen. So, in fact, she would no longer be intact. So, you know, at that most basic level, she's no longer a virgin. But at the much more kind of important, kind of metaphorical level, she has had things done to her that no pure woman should have done to her. She becomes, as it were, metaphorically, you know, the fallen woman that she was accused of being.
I said that she wasn't pregnant, and shortly after this, she dies. She dies in Buckingham Palace, much to Victoria's, you know, disagreement, because, you know, there was supposed to be a ball that night and it has to be cancelled. Do we actually know now what was wrong with her?
Well, interestingly, the family are determined that there will be what we call a post-mortem. And Flora had insisted in her dying days, I want a post-mortem when I die, because I want the world to know that I wasn't pregnant. Because the anxiety is, if there isn't a post-mortem, the rumour will get out that she died perhaps in childbirth or of a botched abortion or something like that. So the Hastings family insist on a panel of six doctors. attending the post-mortem. Some of their doctors, some of the doctors belonging to the court, so there can be no doubt. And the doctors produce a long description of what's the matter with her, which is published in the newspapers. I mean, this is extraordinary, the degree of public interest in this. If you can imagine, it would be... I mean, we're often very interested in celebrity deaths, aren't we? George Michael, Amy Winehouse, and we get the coroner might release a few details, but we don't get the whole thing quite rightly as a matter of taste and decency. Here, the whole thing is put before the nation in the press, which is extraordinary. The symptoms they describe, I'm told by Dr. Friends, sound like it's stomach cancer, probably. There may well have been something else. Somebody suggested to me Crohn's disease, a sort of underlying, that wouldn't have killed her, but it might be an underlying ongoing state of affairs. There's sort of there's ligatures that are binding up her inside, that are blocking her gut, in effect, and that's why it swells. It may have been liver cancer. It's very, very hard to read post-mortem, which are 150 years old, because their vocabulary is not our vocabulary.
And just before we move on from this story, now, she was very young. This was all happening before Albert comes along. But, you know, Victoria is not covering herself in glory particularly here. But in terms of at the time, what did this scandal do for her? You know, public image is probably the wrong word. It's a modern way of looking at it. But what did people think?
Well, the extraordinary thing is that everybody knew about it. Anybody that read a newspaper knew about it. You know, we think today of they would have had, you know, the Royal Family might have hired a PR to do some crisis management. Well, although they tried desperately, they didn't manage it. So everybody knows. There are prayers said for Flora Hastings in churches on Sundays. I mean, it's that much of a kind of public matter. There are horrible, horrible kind of pieces in the press about Victoria telling her that she should fall onto her knees and beg forgiveness of Lady Flora. The suggestions that Barrisley and her governors should slink off back to Germany. I mean, it's absolutely appalling. One time Victoria goes out in her coach shortly after Flora's died, and somebody shouts out from the crowd, "Who's belly up now?" I mean, that's, you know, again, I mean, I can only sort of say, if somebody yelled that at a member of our royal family now, it would be so offensive. So this idea that the level of sort of public discourse was much more high-toned then than it is now, absolutely not. It feels like a sort of awful sort of knockabout farce, but with a very, very nasty undertone. It did hurry. I mean, there was a real feeling she might be forced to abdicate, and that the next in line to the throne, who was her uncle, a very, very unsavoury man, who's King of Hanover, would have to come and reign in her stead. I mean, there was a suggestion, I think there was a worry, is this is what happens when you have a woman on the throne. I mean, it's been 150 years since you had a woman on the throne. That was Queen Mary, but she had her husband, King William, with her. This is what happens when you have a woman on the throne and an unmarried woman on the throne. I mean, literally, the polity falls apart.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Catherine Hughes, and we're talking about her book Victorians Undone, Tales of the Flesh in the Age of Decorum. And Catherine, we're going to move on to another famous figure of the period now, Charles Darwin. Whenever we think of Charles Darwin now, from this age, we'll picture him with a long white beard. But actually, he only had that beard, the clue might be given in the fact that it was white, towards the end of his life. In the book, you talk about, well, the first public appearance of this beard, which is at a soiree at the Royal Society in 1866. What happens?
Well, Darwin hasn't been in public life for a few years because he's been suffering from ill health. So he's been down in his country estate in Kent. He decides to come up for this really swish do at the Royal Academy, Burlington House, where the Royal Academy is now. And because he's going to be introduced to the Prince of Wales. So it's a really, really important occasion. He turns up. And what's mortifying, because he's a very shy man, is that he goes into the room and it's full of scientists and people he's known for a long time, and nobody recognises him. people literally blank him. He has to go up to people, touch them on the shoulder and kind of go, it's me, it's Charles Darwin, which is, can you imagine how awful that would be? And it was simply because the last time anyone had seen him, he hadn't had a beard. He'd had those big mutton-chop whiskers that men used to have through the 1850s, but he had now grown the beard that we all associate with him. And of course, it had changed him completely.
Now, when we see portraits or even some photographs of eminent figures from the beginning of the Victorian period or, you know, the mid-Victorian period, they're all clean-shaven. The idea of a beard was associated with working-class people from the East End or, you know, sailors or whatever. Then suddenly they all look like, you know, they're from the modern East End. Everybody's suddenly got... everybody looks like they're from Hackney all of a sudden. Why did beards become fashionable?
You know, you're absolutely right. Prior to, let's say, 1852, the beard was a sign that a man was up to no good. As you say, he was a ruffian, he was a Chartist, he was a foreigner, you know, not the sort of thing you'd want to be associated with. Indeed, in the Houses of House of Commons, there was only one man who had a beard, and he had to carry a thick cane with him to sort of whack small boys in the street who might name call after him. I mean, what changes is, as always, it's a variety of things. First of all, Britain comes out of the 1840s. The 1840s have been very, very difficult, the Hungry 40s, Chartism has, you know, with its demands for annual parliament and working class reform, that seems to have been vanquished. We have the Great Exhibition in 1851, which suggests the economy is on the uprise. You know, Britain is feeling quite good about itself. So suddenly, you know, when you feel good, when the nation feels quite prosperous, when it feels like your livelihood is not about to be taken away, you can start experimenting a bit. And this is partly what happens. There's a sense in which, you know, we don't have to mark ourselves out as deeply respectable. Then what you also have is that famously the Crimean War comes along a couple of years later. And that's the first war that's photographed. Photographs come back from the front. And what it shows is our soldiers growing beards out there. Because it's practical, it's difficult to shave, you know, when you're in the army. It's also warm, a beard is warm. So suddenly the idea of being a hero is combined with having a beard. So suddenly it's no longer, you know, the sign of a scoundrel, but the sign of somebody that you quite like to emulate. And what happens, rather sadly, is that people who are never going to go out to the Crimea, who are never going to go any further than Folkestone, start growing beards because it's a sort of manly, roughy-tufty kind of thing to do. It just looks like you are leading a life of kind of bravery and adventure, even if actually, you know, you're a grocer or you run a factory.
And you talk about how there's also, particularly within the middle classes, almost like a shift in how masculinity is perceived.
Yeah, I mean, what happens is, what anthropologists would say is that as mid-Victorian prosperity gets underway, men are going out to work, as they always have done, but they're going out to work in offices. Now, whether that's you're a barrister, you're a grocer, you're a clerk, the fact is you're working somewhere where there's a roof and some heating. You know, it's you're not doing something physical. And that, again, can make you feel slightly not a proper man. So there's this sense in which you're going to grow a beard to show that, yes, you may actually be sort of doing something very, very boring, like totting up figures or selling cheese or, you know, doing something very, very mild, but actually you're a real man. And that's when we start to see those kind of extraordinary beards, which are just absolutely amazing. Then what you get, of course, is in the public press, an awful lot of very bad science comes along to explain why it's absolutely essential that a man should grow a beard. Now, the reasons why a man might... I can't help noticing you don't have one, but let me tell you, if you had a beard, it would mean that you wouldn't have toothache. It would provide a nice sort of mask for germs. It would stop germs getting... So you wouldn't get any flu. You could use it as a handy scarf in winter or a sunshield in the summer. And it would mean, and this was very, very crucial in the great sort of capitalist fight in life, that you could hide any signs of weakness or emotion behind your beard. So we get this kind of popular outpouring of what I call bad science, saying it's only natural, a man must have a beard because it does these great things. Of course, the obvious question is, if it's so good at stopping toothache, colds, and protecting you from the sun, why don't women and children have them? That's, you know, that would be obvious then, we'd all have them. So the science doesn't really stand up.
Well, I have had a beard in the past, and I can vouch that at least it does keep you warm in the winter, but none of the other things. Darwin himself... Now, he's not a follower of fashion. He's not having a beard because it's a thing to do. Why does Darwin grow a beard?
Well, Darwin grows a beard for a reason, actually, that I found that many other men did, but they never really talked about it, which was that since he'd been a young man, he'd been very badly afflicted by eczema. red flaky skin, really, really severe, that had made him feel so self-conscious. As a young man, he would often leave naturalists sort of, you know, he'd go with friends to hunt beetles, say, on the North Wales coast, but would leave halfway through because he was just so embarrassed about how he looked. It didn't just inflame his skin, but it sort of made his lips swell up as well. He thought that, rather sadly, he thought he looked hideous. That's the word he used. So it made great sense for you to grow a beard. I mean, for one thing, you're not constantly roughing up the skin every day with shaving, so it soothes it. But also it covered it up. And what I discovered once I started sort of attending properly to other case histories is that men often grew beards for all the sorts of reasons that make complete sense. You know, if you've got smallpox scars, for instance, and many people did, of course, sensible to grow a beard. Dickens, I think, grew a beard because he had a weak chin that he was slightly self-conscious about. Well, again, you know, I've got a weak chin. If I could grow a beard, I'd have one. You know, I can see why that would work. Longfellow, the American poet who spent a lot of time in Britain, he'd got horrible facial scars from trying to rescue his wife from a burning building. So all these very, very practical reasons why men grew beards. The interesting thing is they usually didn't fess up to it. That's the point. They usually said, as Darwin did, Darwin said, that my wife made me do it.
We mentioned about how difficult it is to gain information from Flora's autopsy and at this distance to know for real how she actually died. Now, with Darwin, as you said, he suffered from numerous ailments all his life. But actually, it turns out his beard might help us to finally find out what it was that finished him off.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, he suffered from terrible, terrible health. And in a way, of course, it was a strategy that worked very well for him. A bit like Elizabeth Barrett in her couch meant that she could keep the world at bay and write poetry. Well, Darwin, of course, could keep the world at bay by saying, I'm not well enough to live the life of a public man. I can stay at home in Kent and do my research. He suffered, as you rightly said, from a whole host of symptoms, lots of gut problems, fainting fits, vomiting.
You mentioned his wind particularly in the book.
Terrible wind, you know, and there's been all sorts of theories as to what this could be. So the sort of things people talk about, again, Crohn's disease, again, possibly something called Chagas disease, which is something you pick up from beetles that he might have that he did indeed have interaction with when he was on the Beagle. Somebody rather modernly suggested lactose intolerance. It could have been hypochondria. You know, we really don't know. The very thrilling thing is that some of Darwin's beard's hairs have been passed down through the family. So they're now in the possession of one of his great-grandsons. And very interestingly, the last couple of years, a couple of those beard hairs have been subject to analysis and some of Darwin's genome has been unravelled. Now, a lot of work remains to be done. It has to be clear, you know, we aren't suddenly on the cusp of saying what ails him. But it does look as though, in the next few years, that information will become available, which is just so exciting. I mean, this notion that a beard, which is something kind of quite metaphorical, it's something Darwin grows because he thinks he's hideous, might actually end up having this very, very material kind of impact on understanding what was wrong with him.
I'm Alex Cox, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Now, someone else who liked a beard were the Pre-Raphaelites. And there's a portrait by Rossetti, the Kiss Mouth, of a woman. Tell us who this woman is.
She's called Fanny Cornforth, or that's her professional name. That's the name by which she was known as an artist's model. Yes, Boccabacciata, the Kiss Mouth. It's the most beautiful portrait, done in 1859. And art historians identify that painting as sort of marking a real turn in Rossetti's art. So, you know, if you think up until then, the age of sort of 33 or so, he had been producing that medieval style that we so associate with the Pre-Raphaelites and with his partner that we most associate with him, Lizzie Siddle. So those very, very wraith-like, very thin, slender girls looking like they could do with a good meal. Suddenly, he paints this woman, Fanny Cornforth, in 1859. She's completely different, completely voluptuous. It's not a medieval look. It's much more high Renaissance. It's very luscious, very sensual, very, very sexy. And that's, as I say, what art historians kind of pinpoint as a big shift in his work. But also what I was very interested in is that Fanny Cornforth turns out to be a woman with whom Rossetti was partnered for 25 years of his life. She is the woman with whom he spent far, far more time than anybody else. I mean, the two women we tend to associate are Lizzie Siddle, whom he married briefly, and Jane Morris, who models for all those much later pictures, the sort of dark lady pictures. But here's this woman, Fanny Cornforth, who actually is there in the background throughout his life and models for the kind of key paintings.
And yet she's not as well known as those other women you mentioned. So why? What are the reasons?
Well, the reasons, I think, are... No, she's not known at all. I mean, until about 1940, I don't think she was named in any Rossetti biographies, and there have been many, many Rossetti biographies. The reason she wasn't named was because Rossetti's family and friends, who were very careful about guarding his posthumous image, he died young, died in his early 50s, couldn't stand Fanny Cornforth. She was a loud, vulgar woman. They like to put it about that she was a prostitute. That's a bit debatable. It depends what you think a prostitute is exactly, and certainly she was a woman who slept with Rossetti and needed to be supported by him financially in return. Now, whether that is actually... I mean, I was very interested in the fact that prostitution is such a sort of kind of specific term for a whole range of kind of sexual relationships that a woman might have with a more powerful man. But as far as, you know, posterity was concerned, she was a vulgar prostitute who was a millstone around Rossetti's neck, and they really wanted to write her out of the story.
And, well, we know that the Victorians had a huge amount of hypocrisy around prostitution, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that. And, you know, again, it brings up to mind Flora Hastings again, and this idea is, you know, you mentioned this examination that she has, and there's an act enacted which basically forces prostitutes to be examined with a speculum in the way that Flora had, you know, and yet half of the population of London was in some way engaged in prostitution.
You're absolutely right. I was very, very keen to try and complicate our ideas about what prostitution is. I mean, again, we have these kind of very strange ideas that there's somebody called a prostitute, but it hangs around the Haymarket, you know, with lipstick and a revealing frock and sort of, you know, says hello ducky on corners and kind of lures men in. Of course, it's not like that at all. A lot of working class women and lower middle class women would have found themselves at some point reliant on a man to whom they weren't married for financial support. And then these relationships are often quite transient. You might sort of have a lover and he might pay you because you can't make a living from doing what you're doing. Perhaps, you know, you're a seamstress or you're making hats. So you may well have a lover or several, and they're paying you a bit of money, small amounts of money, and that helps you until perhaps, you know, you meet somebody and you marry and you put prostitution behind you. Or perhaps you marry one of those men, or perhaps you simply set up house with him but everybody thinks you're married. In other words, there's just such a huge variety of reasons why somebody might enter those kind of relationships. A woman who is widowed or abandoned, perhaps her husband is in the merchant navy, goes off to sea, she's going to need to find various sources of income. And at some point in her life, she may well find herself financially dependent on a man, and she may well offer some sort of sexual relationship in return. But to call it prostitution actually sort of glamorises it. I mean, I think it's just a much more kind of ordinary, everyday activity.
And indeed, as you said, so Fanny's in a relationship with Rossetti on and off for about 25 years. You know, he's paying her rent. And then he marries Elizabeth Siddle. And where does that leave Fanny?
Well, indeed. So a few months after he painted Fanny in The Kissed Mouth, she is appalled to discover that he has gone and married Lizzie Siddle. Appalled because she didn't even know this woman existed. I mean, I think that's the extraordinary thing. She thinks she's met a nice young artist. They seem to be getting on. He's painting some gorgeous pictures of her. And my goodness, the next thing she hears, he's in Paris. He's on honeymoon with this woman. And she's absolutely kind of, I mean, that is the end of her life, because what does a working class woman do when their provider, as it were, simply goes away? What she does very sensibly is that she finds somebody to marry herself. She's got another lover on the side, very sensibly. You always want a plan B. And she marries him. He's called Timothy Hughes, but actually his mother's married name is Cornforth. She likes that name so much, and it is a very pretty name, that she takes that name. And it's a sort of tit for tat, really, but it's also a very pragmatic move. You know, what am I going to do? I have got to find a man. And she does.
Where does she end up?
Well, what happens is that, I mean, famously, Lizzie Siddle dies, very sadly, about 2 years into the marriage. And within weeks, Fanny is back and living with Rossetti. And from then on, they're really together for the rest of Rossetti's life, on and off. I mean, Rossetti conducts parallel relationships. He's a man that's very, very happy in sort of triangular relationships, perhaps two men and one woman. I don't mean literally sleeping in bed together, but I mean just the emotional complexity. He likes always to be in a sort of state of flux. And then actually, Fanny finds herself having to, as it were, kind of work around that to triangulate her relationships as well. So she's mainly with Rossetti, but she always has somebody kind of lined up in the wings, which is an entirely sensible thing to do.
I want to move on to the last story in the book for the last part of the show. And this is the story of the, well, familiar sounding to modern ears, I think, Sweet Fanny Adams, which has become a phrase now. But this is basically the story of an incredibly grotesque murder of an 8-year-old girl in 1867. Tell us briefly what happens.
Well, it's an extraordinarily sad story. 1867, the small market town of Alton in Hampshire. One Saturday afternoon, high summer, end of August, little Fanny Adams, 8-year-old girl, goes with her slightly younger sister and her friend out to play in something called the Flood Meadow. It's a field. It's really, I mean, it's about 100 yards from her cottage home. It's where all the children of the town go to play, splash around. The river is very shallow at that point. What happens is that they're accosted by a respectable-looking young man who does that classic thing of offering them money if they will run some races. And of course they're charmed. I mean, these are children from poor but respectable backgrounds. The offer of halfpennies, lovely, that means sweets, absolutely, of course. So they do some running up and down. The young man asks Fanny to come up into a field with him, sends the other two children away to go and buy sweets. And that's the last time Fanny's ever seen. Very, very sadly, nobody knows in a sense what happens next. By the evening, Fanny's mother is beginning to get worried about where she is. Men from that part of the town go out, form a search party. It's beginning to get dusk. They go into the hop field where Fanny was last seen with the stranger, and what they come across is truly appalling. They come across Fanny's head neatly propped up on a couple of hop poles, and as the search kind of unfurls, they find more and more bits of her. She's been sort of scattered over the field, so there's an arm here, there's a leg there, the torso has been slit, all the entrails have brought out. I mean, it's an absolutely horrific scene.
And, well, the guy that's done this, he's, I mean, caught immediately. It's obvious who's murdered her. There's a trial. He's eventually found guilty and hanged. But I don't want to talk about the murder and the trial. I want to talk about the situation of children at this time, because you speculate what would have happened if he hadn't killed her. And indeed, it's difficult to know this at this distance, but it seems obvious to modern eyes that he's raped her or molested her and then murdered her to cover that up. Like, that's what would happen now. But actually, that seems like, in those days, like, unnecessary?
Yeah, I mean, that's the extraordinary thing. If you look at the details of the trial and also of the kind of conversations that go on behind the scenes with the lawyers, they can't understand why on earth he murdered her. Completely unnecessary. 8-year-old girl, okay, let's assume that he raped her. They can get their head around that. That's very unpleasant. Obviously, he let his lust get out of hand. But there's nothing really in the kind of conversations around the murder to suggest that it's more disgusting that he did it to an 8-year-old than an 18-year-old or a 28-year-old. So the puzzle really is, why murder her? You'd go to jail, obviously, for raping somebody, but there's not that absolute sort of visceral horror that we would have now of the difference between somebody who rapes a child and somebody rapes an adult. You know, the absolute appallingness of raping an 8-year-old. There's none of that there. It's simply a young man who's been out drinking and let his lust, that's the word they use, run away with him. And so what they can't understand, and this is why there's a huge sort of campaign to get him pardoned, is they can't understand, it's completely irrational, why he would need to murder her. They just don't understand. It doesn't make sense. I mean, lawyers write it and say, absolutely, it's ridiculous. Why would he murder her? You know, he would just simply go to jail for a few years for rape. But the murder makes no sense at all. He must have been mad. That's the point.
And as you said, he would have gone to prison, but only for a couple of years. Whereas what he does, you know, he murders her and therefore he'll be hanged.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it does. It doesn't make any kind of sense. I mean, I think my feeling would be he was a very, very respectable young man. He was a law clerk from a very respectable church-going family. He obviously had what we would call some mental health problems now. And I suspect that it's just the poor... He never ever admitted to having raped her at all. He simply went mad and murdered her. And I suspect it's a matter of sort of self-image. It's just too appalling to him to admit to the fact that he raped her. It is actually easier for his, to keep his sort of, you know, his ego identity intact, to say, I went mad and I murdered her, is actually more preferable than saying, I actually sexually assaulted this child.
Just to finish off then, just in general, to what extent are, I mean, you mentioned some ways in which, at the beginning, when we were talking about the book in general terms, about how the Victorians were like us in a lot of their concerns about around the body. How else are we different? Let's talk about how we've changed, you know, in terms of our attitude to our own bodies. What's different now?
Well, I would think, I mean, first of all, we have at our disposal all sorts of technologies that mean that we can manage our interactions much more. By which I mean, you know, that we're very lucky, neither you nor I smell. For instance, we have deodorants, we have showers. So we have all sorts of technologies that mean that unless you're very unlucky and you get on the tube on a very, very hot day, you won't be kind of assaulted by smell. We also have a very particular ways of making sure exactly on a tube that we don't knock against anybody, rub up against anybody. We have, in other words, different sorts of boundaries and technologies that allow us to do that. I also think that we're more able to talk about the body precisely because we have those boundaries in place. I speculate in the book that the reason why Victorians appear not to talk a great deal about these kinds of things, wind or constipation, all those kind of slightly embarrassing things, is that the stakes are so high. It's there all the time. It's overwhelming. And so therefore, the only way is to really kind of construct a kind of silence and murder around it. Otherwise, you would simply be overwhelmed by those sensations. I suspect that we are slightly more, we feel safer in our bodies because we actually have boundaries that are slightly more intact. Therefore, paradoxically, we are able to talk about these things much more easily. I mean, I'm amazed what people share on YouTube videos, for instance, about, you know, their everyday lives or what happens to them in the bathroom. I'm quite staggered, but I suspect that's because, in that instance, we are at one remove. We're not standing outside the bathroom door listening.
I've been talking to Catherine Hughes. We've been talking about her book, Victorians Undone, Tales of the Flesh in the Age of Decorum, which is out now from Fourth Estate Books. Catherine, thank you so much for coming in and telling me about it.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.